The terse typewritten note slipped under my door in a sealed envelope confirmed my appointment with India's single biggest internal security challenge, which is what the Prime Minister called the Maoists. I'd been waiting for months to hear from them. I had to be at the Ma Danteshwari Mandir, that's temple, in Dantewara, Chhattisgarh, at any four given times on two given days. That was to take care of bad weather, punctures, blockades, transport strikes, and sheer bad luck. The note said, writer should have camera, tikka, which is a bindi, and coconut. Meter will have cap, Hindi Outlook magazine, and bananas. The password will be Namaskar Guruji. Namaskar Guruji. I wondered whether the meter and greeter would be expecting a man and whether I should get myself a mustache. There are many ways to describe Dantewara. It's an oxymoron. It's a border town smack in the heart of India. It's the epicenter of a war. It's an upside-down, inside-out town. In Dantewara, the police wear plain clothes and the rebels wear uniforms. The jail superintendent is in jail and the prisoners are free. 300 of them escaped from the old town jail 2 years ago, but it's filled now again. Women who've been raped are in police custody. The rapists give speeches in the bazaar. Across the Indravati River, in the area controlled by the Maoists, is the place the police call Pakistan. There the villages are empty, but the forest is full of people. Children who ought to be in school run wild. In the lovely forest villages, the concrete school buildings have either been blown up and lie in a heap, or they're full of policemen. The deadly war that's unfolding in the jungle is a war that the government of India is both proud and shy of. Operation Green Hunt has been proclaimed as well as denied. P. Chidambaram, India's Home Minister and CEO of the war, says it does not exist, that it's a media creation. And yet, substantial funds have been allocated to it, and tens of thousands of troops are being mobilized for it. Though the theater of war is in the jungles of central India, it will have serious consequences for us all. If ghosts are the lingering spirits of someone or something that has ceased to exist, then perhaps the National Mineral Development Corporation's new four-lane highway crashing through the forest is the opposite of a ghost. Perhaps it's the harbinger of what is still to come. The antagonists in the forest are disparate and unequal in almost every way. On one side is a massive paramilitary force armed with the money, the firepower, the media, and the hubris of an emerging superpower. On the other, ordinary villagers armed with traditional weapons, backed by a superbly organized, hugely motivated Maoist guerrilla fighting force with an extraordinary and violent history of armed rebellion. The Maoists and the paramilitary are old adversaries and have fought older avatars of each other several times before. Telangana in the 50s, West Bengal, Bihar, Srikakulam in Andhra Pradesh in the late 60s and 70s, and then again Andhra Pradesh, Bihar, and Maharashtra in the 80s all the way through to the present. They are familiar with each other's tactics and have studied each other's combat manuals closely. Each time it seemed as though the Maoists or their previous avatars had not just been defeated, but literally physically exterminated. Each time they have re-emerged more organized, more determined, and more influential than ever. Today, the insurrection has spread through the mineral-rich forests of Chhattisgarh, Jharkhand, Orissa, and West Bengal, homeland to millions of India's tribal people, dreamland to the corporate world. It's easier on the liberal conscience to believe that the war in the forests is a war between the government of India and the Maoists, who call elections a sham, parliament a pigsty, and have openly declared their intention to overthrow the Indian state. It's convenient to forget that indigenous people in central India have a history of resistance that predates Mao by centuries. That's a truism, of course. If they didn't, they wouldn't exist. Their rebellions were cruelly crushed and many thousands killed, but the people were never conquered. Even after independence, tribal people were at the heart of the first uprising that could be described as Maoist in Naxalbari in the village West Bengal, where the word Naxalite, now used interchangeably with Maoist, originates. Since then, Naxalite politics has been inextricably entwined with tribal uprisings, which says as much about the tribals as it does about the Naxalites. This legacy of rebellion has left behind a furious people who have been deliberately isolated and marginalized by the Indian government. The Indian Constitution, the moral underpinning of Indian democracy, was adopted by Parliament in 1950. It was a tragic day for indigenous people. The Constitution ratified colonial policy and made the state custodian of tribal homelands. Overnight, it turned the entire indigenous population into squatters on their own land. It denied them their traditional rights to forest produce. It criminalized a whole way of life. In exchange for the right to vote, it snatched away their right to livelihood and dignity. Having dispossessed them and pushed them into a downward spiral of indigence in a cruel sleight of hand, the government began to use their own penury against them. Each time it needed to displace a large population for dams, irrigation projects, or mines, it talked of bringing tribals into the mainstream or of giving them the fruits of modern development. Of the tens of millions of internally displaced people, more than 30 million by big dams alone, refugees of India's progress, the great majority are tribal people. So when the government begins to talk of tribal welfare, it's time to worry. Over the past 5 years or so, the governments of Chhattisgarh, Jharkhand, Orissa, and West Bengal have signed hundreds of MOUs with corporate houses worth several billion rupees, all of them secret, for steel plants, sponge iron factories, power plants, aluminum refineries, dams, and mines. In order for the MOUs to be translated into real money, the people must be moved, and therefore this war. When a country that calls itself a democracy openly declares war within its borders, what does that war look like? Does the resistance stand a chance? Should it? Who are the Maoists? Are they just violent nihilists foisting an outdated ideology on tribal people, goading them into a hopeless insurrection? What lessons have they learned from their past experience? Is armed struggle intrinsically undemocratic? Is the sandwich theory of ordinary people being caught in the crossfire between the state and the Maoists an accurate one? Are Maoists and tribals two entirely discrete categories, as is being made out? Do their interests converge? Have they learned anything from each other? Have they changed each other? The day before I left, my mother called, sounding sleepy. I've been thinking, she said, with a mother's weird instinct, what this country needs is revolution. An article on the internet says that Israel's Mossad is training 30 high-ranking Indian police officers in the techniques of targeted assassinations to render the Maoist organization headless. There's talk in the press about the new hardware that's been bought from Israel: laser rangefinders, thermal imaging equipment, and unmanned drones so popular with the U.S. Army. Perfect weapons to use against the poor. I arrived at the Maa Danteshwari Mandir well in time for my appointment First day, first show. I had my camera, my small coconut, and a powdery red tikka on my forehead. I wondered if someone was watching me and having a laugh. Within minutes, a young boy approached me. He had a cap and a backpack school bag, chipped red nail polish on his fingernails. No Hindi outlook, no bananas. "Are you the one who's going in?" he asked me. "No, namaskar, Guruji." I didn't know what to say. He took out a soggy note from his pocket and handed it to me. It said, "Outlook nahi mila." Couldn't find outlook. "And the bananas?" "I ate them," he said. "I got hungry." He really was a security threat. His backpack said, "Charlie Brown, not your ordinary blockhead." He said his name was Mangtu. I soon learned that Dandakaranya, the forest I was about to enter, was full of people who had many names and fluid identities. It was like balm to me, that idea. How lovely not to be stuck with yourself, to become someone else for a while. We walked to the bus stand only a few minutes away from the temple. It was already crowded. Things happened quickly. There were two men on motorbikes. There was no conversation, just a glance of acknowledgement, a shifting of body weight, the revving of engines. I had no idea where we were going. We passed the house of the superintendent of police, which I recognized from my last visit. He was a candid man, the superintendent. "See, ma'am, frankly speaking, this problem can't be solved by us, police or military. The problem with these tribal people is they don't understand greed. Unless they become greedy, there's no hope for us. I have told my boss, remove the force and instead put a TV in every room, every home. Everything will be automatically sorted out." In no time at all, we were riding out of town. No tail. It was a long ride, 3 hours by my watch. It ended abruptly in the middle of nowhere, on an empty road with forest on either side. Mangtu got off, and I did too. The bikes left, and I picked up my backpack and followed the small internal security challenge into the forest. It was a beautiful day. The forest floor was a carpet of gold. In a while, we emerged on the white sandy banks of a broad flat river. It was obviously monsoon-fed, so now it was more or less a sand flat. At the center, a stream ankle-deep, easy to wade across. And across was Pakistan. "Out there, ma'am," the candid SP had said to me, "my boys shoot to kill." I remembered that as we began to cross. I saw us in a policeman's rifle sights, tiny figures in a landscape, easy to pick off. But Mangtu seemed quite unconcerned, and I took my cue from him. So...